I am joined now by Dr. Craig von Busick, author of his new book, Victor, The Final Battle of Ulysses S. Grant. Dr. von Busick, thank you so much for joining me.
Well, thank you, Josh. It's a pleasure to be with you.
I'm so glad that you chose to come speak with us. I want to, before we get into some of the things specifically about Grant, I wanted to ask you about your book. What inspired you to take a closer look at the life of Ulysses S. Grant?
Well, I first heard the story about U.S. Grant's final 2 years when I watched the Ken Burns documentary on the Civil War, and it really moved me to see that this man who was so important to the history of the United States went through so much of a challenge in his final 2 years. For those who don't know that story, he was a two-term president, and we all know he was, you know, savior of the Union with his strategy in the Civil War. But then he started he joined his son's investment firm, a Wall Street investment firm. But unfortunately, there was a unscrupulous partner who was stealing their money for 2 years in a giant Ponzi scheme. Mm-hmm. And so overnight, the whole investment firm collapsed, and Grant was left without any money. And then only a few months after this, Grant was diagnosed with incurable throat cancer. So now he has no money and he is dying, and he's very concerned about his wife and how she's going to be taken care of, and his children and their reputation and their finances, because all of his kids had invested in the firm as well. Mm-hmm. And so the book tells the story of what he did after receiving this news and how he reacted to this crisis in his life.
Well, that's a really it's a really powerful story, I think, and it's something that, you're right, it isn't really well known. Like before starting your book, I had no idea. I mean, Grant was just kind of this figure in history that I was like, yeah, he won the Civil War, but then I never thought about what he did after he was president. That's a really cool story. Continuing on talking about U.S. Grant, I wanted to ask you, what do you think? What are some lessons that leaders today can learn from the example of U.S. Grant?
Well, Joshua, like the rest of us, U.S. Grant was a fragile, frail human being. Mm-hmm. He had his strengths, but he also had his weaknesses. And so one of the things that I learned in studying Grant, and I ended up doing research and writing the book over the course of 2.5 years, but I learned that Grant, even though he did have weaknesses, he was able to overcome those weaknesses through his faith in God first, through his strong marriage. He had an amazing marriage to his wife, Julia, and they truly loved and supported each other. Through his education, he was a graduate of West Point, and then just through his hard work, he was able to overcome the difficulties that took place in his life. So, for example, Grant had the disease of alcoholism. Mm-hmm. And back then, they didn't realize that it was a disease. They thought it was just a character flaw. And so he was on the west coast of the United States, very far from his wife in the 1850s. This was before there was a continental railroad connecting the country. So to get across the continental United States, you had to go by covered wagon, or else you had to go by ship down to Panama and across the Isthmus of Panama before the canal had been built. Mm-hmm. And back up to California. And so it was a very dangerous journey either way, and it was nearly impossible for Julia and her two small boys to travel with Ulysses. So he was very lonely on the West Coast. He had tried many different things to make money to be able to bring them so that they could be together as a family. And they all failed, not because of a lack of hard work on his part, but just honestly, bad luck. And so this caused him to go into a depression, and he started to drink. And he was caught being drunk on duty a couple of times. Now, the problem for Grant was that he was very short, or relatively short, 5'8", and he was very thin, like 125 pounds.
Oh, wow.
So he couldn't handle very much alcohol. And so his commander gave him an ultimatum: either you resign or I will have you court-martialed. Well, he couldn't imagine being court-martialed, and so he resigned. And he went back to St. Louis, where his wife's family lived, and his father-in-law gave him a chunk of land and a slave to farm that land. And he worked diligently side by side with this slave. He ended up giving the slave his freedom as the war approached because he thought it was the best thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
But sadly, when Grant was farming his land, the country got hit with a massive financial depression. And so as hard as Grant worked, he wasn't able to sell his crops. And so he just had to find out what he would do next. And so at that time, when he was facing really utter ruin, he could have sold that slave for $1,000, but he was becoming more and more of an abolitionist as he saw slavery was a cancer that was tearing apart the country.
Mm-hmm.
And so he gave that slave his freedom, asked his dad for a job because his dad had a string of leather goods stores across the north, and he took his family and moved north. And so there's a lot to learn from him in that time, because when he got to the north, after a year, the Civil War broke out. He was able to go back into the army, and the rest is history. And I think that's a great example for us when we're facing adversity, which he faced several different things, but he never stopped working hard. He never stopped trusting in God, and he never stopped believing in his wife and his family. And that's a role model for us for this day.
Yeah, definitely. Those things of trusting in God and being with your family and working hard, those are definitely qualities that we need to strive to emulate nowadays. But I wanted to ask you, how similar is kind of the political climate of today, because we're so divided politically, you know, compared to that of Grant's day and the Civil War? How comparative are those?
Well, we think it's bad now. It was probably 10 or 100 times worse then.
Mm-hmm.
Even though we've had some strife in the last 2 years, and we've had divisions and growing divisions, it does not rise to the level of the total hatred between the Union and the Confederacy in the Civil War. And it also doesn't rise to the level of, you know, open warfare. And during the Civil War, at first, Grant thought that we would be able to defeat the Confederates relatively quickly. He didn't think it would be as quick as others because he had lived in the South and he knew that they were very strongly in favor of keeping their slaves and their way of life.
Mm-hmm.
But he thought that within a year or so that the war would be over. But after the Battle of Shiloh, where I don't remember the exact numbers, but it was one of the bloodiest battles in human history. And it was over the course, well, I'll give you an example without knowing exactly the numbers. More people were killed in the 2-day Battle of Shiloh than had been killed in the Revolutionary War, the War of 1812, and the Indian Wars combined.
Oh, wow. That's crazy.
So in 2 days, more people were killed than in all of the previous American wars combined.
Mm-hmm.
And Grant wrote after the Battle of Shiloh that he came to realize that it would have to be a war of conquest because the Confederates were not going to give up their slaves and their way of life without a fight to the death. And that's exactly what it was. However, Mark Twain, who is in the book as the publisher of Grant's memoirs and also his very good friend, he once said this, and I think there's a lot of wisdom to it. He said, history does not repeat itself, but it often rhymes.
Mm.
And there's a lot of wisdom there because we say history repeats itself. Well, it doesn't really. It's not exact. But many times the same issues arise just in different contexts. And so that's what he meant by history rhyming. And I think that we're seeing a rhyming of history right now in a way that is very similar. Some of the things that we're dealing with have to do with questions of freedom and questions of race and questions of justice. And all of those questions were being asked before and during the Civil War. And so we just need to be praying, and we need to be looking for common ground as much as possible, but also we need to be standing on what we believe to be eternal truth, truth as revealed from God, and not just, the winds of people's thinking as they blow through history. And that's a difficult balance to strike, but it is a balance that we must strike nonetheless.
Most definitely. Just relying on God is kind of utmost importance in all of this. I did want to ask kind of one quick follow-up question about you were saying how history rhymed, and I thought that was really interesting about that line from Mark Twain. Where do you see, how can we avoid kind of the eerie rhyme of another civil war? Because a lot of people are talking about that. We obviously don't want that to happen, aside from prayer and things like that. What can we personally, as individuals, do to avoid that, do you think?
I believe very strongly that we must follow the examples of people like Martin Luther King Jr., Mahatma Gandhi, and of course, Jesus Christ, mm-hmm. in non-violent protests. We must protest when there is something that we see as unjust, but it must be non-violent protest. The reason that the British left India was not because of the violent uprising. It was because they were embarrassed. They were shamed by their behavior, their colonial injustice to the Indian nation through the example and the leadership of Mahatma Gandhi. The same thing here in the United States. One of the reasons that Martin Luther King Jr. was successful as a leader and the civil rights movement was successful in the 1950s and the 1960s was because Martin Luther King insisted on nonviolent protest. Mm-hmm. And again, he said, if we will do this, then the injustice of the white supremacist will be seen for what it is, and the country and the world will recognize that this is wrong and that it must be changed. A similar situation took place in Israel right after World War II, where the British, who had conquered the Turks in World War I and had been the occupying power, were becoming more and more unjust to the Jews, who they had promised to give the land of Palestine to in the midst of World War I through what was called the Balfour Declaration. And yet, because they were afraid of an oncoming war with the Soviets, World War III, after World War II, they chose to buddy up to the Arabs so that they could get the Arab oil, and they chose to break their promise with the Jews in Israel, who were in Israel and in that part of the world for 3,000 years and had been promised that they could return from being scattered throughout the world. That, of course, mm-hmm. was magnified as the Holocaust became known, and people realized that the Jews needed their own nation so they could defend themselves, so that they could be a people group in a nation with a culture, with a religion, and with a military to be able to have a safe haven for their people. And the British were not allowing that. This was at the same time as what was going on with Gandhi in India. Mm-hmm. And so the British were looking quite evil at that point. And the world basically turned its back on the British Empire and said, enough. You need to leave India. You need to leave Palestine. And that's what happened. And I think that if we will follow the same wisdom of the people like David Ben-Gurion and Martin Luther King Jr. and Gandhi and Jesus, I believe that is the way to a peaceful restoration of peace. We'll never have complete peace until the Prince of Peace, Jesus, returns.
Mm-hmm.
But until then, as the Bible says, as much as it depends on you, live at peace with all men.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely words to live by. Boy, the British weren't hitting on much as it comes to colonialism there, were they? But
well, it was a system whose time had come to an end, and the world knew it. The British took a long time to recognize it, but they finally did.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. But those are good words to live by, especially the peaceful part. That's just very important in our society. I mean, that's basically heaping burning coals upon our adversary's head when we
very
pray
well
for
said.
Them and we protest in peace. I did want to ask you a fundamentally important question. Actually, this is one of the most important questions that, sir, you might encounter in your entire life. If I might be so bold, what was your favorite a child's toy when you were growing up?
This is vitally important because it's a glimpse into our psyche and our soul, right? I remember a game that was a precursor to video games, and it was a handheld football video game, but the characters were just dashes, and so you had each team had a series of dashes, and you would hand the football off to one dash from another dash, and then he would dash down the court, and you would do this with your thumbs going a mile a minute to get to try and score. And everybody had these games. Now, this was at a time, you know, the other big game at that time was Pong, which you set up on your TV and you played ping pong using this these circular guides to be able to move your paddle back and forth as the little electronic ball went across your TV screen. That was the level of video games when I was a kid. And so my favorite game growing up would have been that football game.
Man, that was cutting edge technology, wasn't it?
It was.
Well, that was great. Thank you so much, Dr. Craig Von Busick, for your insights. That was just a really great conversation. Make sure you check out his book, Victor: The Final Battle of Ulysses S. Grant. Dr. Von Busick, thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Joshua. It was an honor to be with you.
It was an honor to speak with you. You have a great rest of your day.
You too, sir.